Bloomberg Surveillance with Michael McKee and Tom Keane. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Brad Hintz analyzes both of these performers for Sanford Bernstein, and he joins us now. Brad, let's start with the good guys. Morgan Stanley.
Which one is the good guy?
Well, I'm talking about in terms of terms of quarterly performance here. We will leave the moral judgments out of it. Morgan Stanley, an impressive, very impressive quarter for Jim Gorman. Not only did they perform well overall, but they're the only ones pretty much that I have seen that did well in fixed income currencies and commodities, the FICC group we were talking about earlier on the show.
Absolutely. The commodities business looked like it did very, very well. They put it down to the seasonal effects. There's been a lot of volatility. We haven't seen a shift in terms of like from backwardation to contango or contango to backwardation. So, you know, this implies that there actually was a demand increase rather than just a speculative position taking in their commodities business. You know, commodities has long been one of Morgan Stanley's strengths. It's a tragedy that the banks are being pushed out of it by the regulators. You know, it will go on to someplace else, but nonetheless, you know, this is one where Morgan Stanley's done well. And they also said that their credit business did well, and that has, you know, investment grade credit has always been one of Morgan Stanley's strengths also. You know, in many ways, unfortunately, what we've seen is when the street disappoints in fixed income, Morgan Stanley does well. And when the street does well, Morgan Stanley tends to disappoint. So, you know, weak fixed income quarter, Morgan Stanley did well. You know, thank you, Morgan Stanley.
The other good news in Mr. Gorman's press release today was that they have raised their return on equity significantly. And that was one of the criticisms of his tenure so far, that they had the lowest ROE on the street. They brought that up to almost 10%, just under what he says his goal is. What are they doing right there?
Well, you're seeing the shift into the wealth management business. Now, James has brought over a pool of deposits. These are the Smith Barney retail client deposits. He's ramping up a bank with that. So essentially, the bank sits inside the wealth management business. They're putting on loans at a pretty active pace. Net interest is rising. That's running through the wealth management line. It is not increasing the expenses since it's not really being paid out to the financial advisors. And so what you get is you get this pop in terms of the performance of the wealth management business, and this is falling immediately to the bottom line, pushing the performance of the firm up and shifting the mix of the business, right? It's shifting from the institutional, the trading, investment banking side, over to the wealth management side. That's exactly what the market wants to hear. So, you know, this is one where, you know, James looks almost prescient, and Purcell looks vindicated.
It's interesting. I note that this is a model that a lot of banks are adopting these days. You see a big push by banks that either had it or are getting into it, but trying to increase the wealth management side. I note that Barclays is focused on that. UBS has been trying to dial back on trading and boost wealth management. How big a market is this, and does Morgan Stanley have a differentiator in this that enables them to succeed?
Scale alone is the differentiator on that one. We're not making any more wealth management channels of size, right? So, you know, we've seen the consolidation. So you have Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley roughly the same size, and then you have Wells Fargo right underneath that, and then you have UBS. You know, and UBS has done a very credible job. McCann has done a great job in terms of improving the performance of that business over there. And you're absolutely right. The banks are chasing after continuing fee-driven businesses where they can use channel power. You know, if I can distribute financial assets to the masses, that's a very, very powerful channel. That's a Walmart, right? That's, you know, and so as a result, I can extract value from the originators, from the asset management firms, and I also can get fee-driven advice revenues, which are going to be there during both good times and bad times. You're just seeing a shift where the banks are pulling away from those black box trading models and trying to reduce the capital they use, moving them to fee-driven businesses that don't use as much capital. Now, the question you have is, will the regulators ever allow them to give back their capital?
Well, that's a good question. I wanted to bring up it, particularly in connection with Goldman, but the follow-on question to what you were just saying is, are there enough wealthy people, or are we all getting smarter about having somebody manage our money, that all of these people can keep growing?
Well, we actually have a favorable demographic phenomenon that's occurring, is that the baby boomers are retiring. And so as the baby boomers retire, their 401ks are going to be distributed to them. And so for the first time in many of the lives of the average American, they're going to be handed that $400,000 or $600,000, and they'll have to reinvest it. Now, if they're on the high end of that valuation level, that's where they're going to go, to a Merrill Lynch, a Raymond James, a Morgan Stanley.
Okay.
If they're on the lower end, that's where they're going to go, to an Ameritrade or a Schwab. So we're going to see this transition.
Many would say Goldman Sachs had a great IB quarter. Color that for us. Why is investment banking doing so well?
The good businesses are back, Tom. We've got, you saw M&A has been picking up in North America. Now, we don't have a global M&A pickup, but M&A is rising. That typically happens, when an economy's doing much better and CEOs become confident. And M&A is, if we want to characterize M&A, it's 35 basis points times the size of a deal and paid
right.
six guys in a room.
Exactly, Roman. You got to pay six guys in a room and all goes net clean to the company. That's great. Twitter is the fee. Facebook is the fee. And then it goes away. The door. How do guys like you model M&A?
Believe it or not, we actually have M&A models. So this is just simply the size of the M&A market against global or against GDP by region. You actually can get reasonable forecasts on it. Now, the problem with it is it's lumpy. So it's a reasonable forecast on a year basis, and it's a terrible forecast on a quarterly basis because the deals come in, like that. But, M&A is a relatively easy one. Equity capital markets is the other business that's come back, and that's the underwriting business.
It's like predicting, Mike McKee, whether Jacoby Ellsbury will have a lousy April for the New York Yankees. That didn't happen.
Well, it may be a little different because I'm not sure if there are Yankee batting models in the same sense. Change in the way the investment banks are set up and their business models affected the way you look at this, in the sense we were talking about James Gorman moving Morgan Stanley more into wealth management. Does that give Goldman a freer hand out there, or are they facing more competition from the boutique banks? How does it all play out?
Very good point about the boutiques. Since the crisis, we've actually seen the boutique banks go from about 9% market share in mergers and acquisitions up to about 20%. So there clearly has been a shift. Now, the leaders, the Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys in M&A, the JPMs in M&A, it hasn't really affected them. You've seen, it hurt other players. So M&A tends to be a business of these brands, right? The brands can be a Greenhill, a Lazard, a Morgan Stanley, a Goldman Sachs. But clearly, the guys who are rainmakers, those very senior M&A bankers, they realize that they can go out and set up their own boutique and do very, very well with it.
Who's doing the best at that? And is there anybody who wants to move beyond being a boutique?
Who's doing well? Certainly you can see, a Lazard is the big one in there, but a Greenhill and Evercore are players. Centerview, certainly, Perella, all have done well. The real issue with one of these M&A boutique structures is Is it a great man on a white horse? Is it an artist's colony, a group of guys who've all worked together and decided that they were going to work together? Or can they actually turn it into a continuing business going forward?
Hey, I have a last question here for you, going back to what we talked about at the very beginning when I said the good guys. What's with Goldman Sachs? All of a sudden, they seem to be taking a position on the side of the angels on almost every issue. Is this a public relations strategy? Is this fit with their long-term business that we have not just noticed before?
Goldman is always very good in terms of reading the winds of change, right? Now, you're absolutely right. They're trying on their halo right now, and, we'll see whether it fits. But certainly they've come out on the right side on the high-frequency trading side of this. Now, skeptics have said that their dark pool had not been performing well, and so therefore embracing another venue might make sense to them. But, we'll see this. Goldman is one of the powers in the equity business. Their massive ECM market share allows them to run their equity execution business at a very low margin if they wish, because the profitability can come from the ECM business. They and Credit Suisse, Morgan Stanley, clearly the leaders in this business.
Brad, thank you so much.
Bloomberg Surveillance, weekday mornings at 7 Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.